Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's not often we talk with Hollywood celebrities, but when you have a chance to talk to a man who's made nearly 100 films, been Francois Truffaut's interpreter, and worked with a who's who of American film directors, well, you've got to take the opportunity. My guest today is actor, director, producer, writer, and children's book author Bob Balaban. Balaban is a consummate character actor who's appeared in nearly 100 film and television roles, including Gosford Park, Midnight Cowboy, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and many, many others. And in that time, he's worked with nearly every major film director in Hollywood, from Wes Anderson in this year's Moonrise Kingdom to Robert Altman, Sidney Lumet, Sidney Pollack, Steven Spielberg, Christopher Guest, Mike Nichols, and Woody Allen, and we're probably leaving out a few as well. Balaban has been equally adept behind the camera as a director of television and two well-regarded biopics on George O'Keefe and Bernard and Doris, a film about the heiress Doris Duke. He's been a producer. He was the man with the idea behind Robert Altman's Gosford Park and the writer of film and television and children's books. He's the author of the popular McGraw series of books for young readers, and his latest project is a middle school reader titled The Creature from the Seventh Grade, Boy or Beast. We spoke with him about that project, as well as his long film and acting history today on Studio Tulsa. Bob Balaban, it's great to have you here on Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. It's good to be here.
You've been writing and publishing books for young readers for about 10 years now. I'm interested, 100 motion pictures, you've directed, you produce, you know, Broadway as well as film. What made you get interested in writing for young people?
Well, it was a mistake, as many things in my life happened to be, and I suppose most of our lives. I was trying to make a movie about 11 years ago about a little boy and his bionic dog, and I sent it to Scholastic, which publishes, as you probably know, Harry Potter in the United States, and some other really good things. So I sent it there, thinking they might make a movie out of it. They have a movie division. They turned it down as a movie, but they thought it would make a good series for kids. And based on my treatment, said, well, we think you could write. Let's have you write 6 books, and we'll put it out. And we did, and it sold a couple of million copies, and people seemed to like the books. And then a number of years went by, and I was fairly busy, and I thought, oh, I should be writing children's books again. So I came up with a title, The Creature from the Seventh Grade, and then wrote a book around it and submitted a couple of chapters, and my editor from Scholastic had moved to Viking, so I went to Viking Penguin with her, and they're publishing the book, and we just came out, and it seems to be doing rather nicely, and I'm hard at work on book 2, and then I have to write book 3 and 4. It's kind of like you felt in high school when your homework was never over. There was always another assignment due. But other than that, I really quite enjoyed doing it.
Now, do you have a fan base that knows you no other way other than writing books for them?
Well, I don't really know, actually.
Really?
But I did get a nice amount of response, meaning fan letters from from kids who had read, and teachers and librarians who had read my first series. But because it was 10 years ago, and that age bracket, those were aimed
they're
at kids.
They're gone now, aren't they?
Yeah, it was like 6 to 10, and now they're 16 years old, and they would never buy my book. But people do seem to have heard of it. It was called McGraw, and a fair amount of people probably have older brothers and sisters who've read it, or parents who might say, this might be appropriate for our other child, or else I'm just starting all over into the cold world, and we'll have to see what happens.
Well, in this book, it's a story about Charlie Drinkwater. His middle name shares some resemblance to you.
Well, his middle name is my middle name, and it happens to be a plot point in the first book because even though this is a book about a 12-year-old kid who resembles me very, very much, actually, as a 12-year-old, very short, very thin, not that popular, and very, very smart, although I'm not that smart and I wasn't that unpopular, I kind of made a little extreme version of myself, and then I made it a little more extreme because he turns into an 8.5-foot reptile, which is how I felt in seventh grade. So I kind of stretched the metaphor a little bit. But I have looked, you know, I have dug, not that deep, I suppose, but I have dug into my adolescent years and come up with a fair amount of parallels between me and Charlie Drinkwater, even though I didn't have a tail, but I did feel like one, and I did have a fair amount of pimples, which kind of counts as scales, I would say. Although pimples go away, thank God.
And, of course, the story is about finding your place in that horrible time of middle school, That is such a horrible time. I guess it can be a great time and a horrible time all at the same time.
Well, I think whatever time it is, it's a time of tremendous upheaval. I mean, even if you take it well, you could ride the wave fairly well. But there's no question about it. You wake up one day and you're one person, and then suddenly a month or two or a year later, you have a different voice, you have a different body, you have different responsibilities. You're an adult now, only you don't really have adult responsibilities, and you don't have permission to do a lot of things, but you're not a child anymore. So it's funny, when I thought of the title, at first I thought maybe it would be the creature from the second grade, and then I thought, well, I think seventh grade is for creatures, because the truth is this whole thing about being a creature is sort of a metaphor for puberty that I think he says at one point, Charlie Drinkwater, that while everybody else in his class was growing hair under their arms and mustaches and hair in other places too embarrassing to mention, he was growing a tail, flippers, gill slits, and scales. So it is kind of a metaphor for that. But I think that if you're going to choose to write an adolescent book, 12 years old, seventh grade, is really the year for the big shift. And it's funny and traumatic and exciting, I suppose, in some ways. And I think most people, it's a year that stands out. I think if you asked most of your friends, it is a year that you do tend to remember. I can't really differentiate between fourth and fifth grade, what did I do? Even in high school, I mean, 10th and 11th grade were distinguished by who you were dating or how awful chemistry was. But basically, once you hit seventh grade, that's the dividing line, and that's the year I remembered, so that's what I wrote about.
Mm, yeah, and it's a fun book. You got lots of humor in it, and it must have been a lot of fun to write.
Well, it was fun doing it, yeah. We decided for the story of the book, other than he does turn into a dinosaur, and that takes a little bit of time. But basically, we wanted to surprise people by finding out that this is not about what it's like to be a dinosaur. This is what it's like for a kid who didn't used to be popular to suddenly have a boost in his popularity, because he's actually interesting to the rest of his class. He's not boring. He's not just an egghead. He's a little dangerous. The girls find him possibly interesting. The boys find it exciting. Maybe he'll be on the basketball team. So he does go through this spike in popularity, leaves his true friends behind, and hooks up in the fast lane, and then discovers by the end of the book that his heart really lies with the people who really love him, and it's not all that much fun to do what the popular kids do. It's just fun when you look at it from the other side of the window.
Middle school, and that time is that's a tough time for the smart kids, isn't it?
Well, you know, mostly you're being judged by how you look, what your hair is like, what sports you play, how pretty you are if you're a girl, how good-looking you are if you're a boy. And the qualities that will stand us in good stead when we're grown-ups, like, as you say, being smart, being really interested in something, math or science, those are the exact things that make you join the Geek Squad, basically. And they're the things you can probably make a really good living at. I mean, look at anybody who's ever started an internet startup company. I can guarantee you they weren't, for the most part, they weren't cheerleaders and football players. They were working from the other side of their brain, which I would call the unpopular side.
That's right.
For seventh graders, anyway.
Actors.
And it doesn't do any good to tell a kid, you'll be so popular when you're 20 years old. It's like, no, I want to be popular now.
Yeah. And of course, actors, musicians, artists of all, talk show hosts—we're all part of the Geek Squad.
Yeah, I would say so too. Even some, you know, beautiful actresses, as I dimly recall it. Julia Roberts was not the most popular seventh grader either. She was too tall, and you know, her mouth was too big, and you know, things that made her an international beauty made her stand out too much. As Charlie Drinkwater says at one point to his mother, she says, "Charlie, you're special. You know, you're this. You know, you have a great mind, and look at how unusual you are." And he says, "I don't want to be special. I want to be normal. I'd like to be just like everybody else," which is indeed how it feels, even if you don't have a tail.
In your own career, I know I've read an account where I think an actor friend said, as long as there are intelligent actors that need intelligent subjects in films, you will always work. And that's a great compliment.
Well, actually, it wasn't that I was intelligent. I think they said as long as they need people who seemed intelligent, you could always play doctors and lawyers and psychiatrists. And indeed, that is what happened. I'm not really all that intelligent, although I do work hard, and I'm fairly focused when I'm working. But really, it was just movies kind of put you in a category, and they need to know who you are. Are you a good guy? Are you a bad guy? Are you a smart guy? Are you stupid? Are you urban? And you can go against your type, and certainly people do. But for the most part, movies, as opposed to theater, where you could wear a costume or change your voice or do a lot of different things, movies kind of put you in a place that is somewhat natural to you because the camera is a lot closer than the audience is when you're on a stage.
You know, when I think of your work, I think of a modern-day version of what it was like at the end of the studio period where there were these great actors who, you know, they almost had like, you have Bob Balaban roles and like John McGivern. That's, that's the great character. He probably was
I loved it.
250 films probably. Every film you saw him, there he was. He played a professor. He played a shopkeeper.
You remember Cuddle Zackle, CZ Zackle? I don't know if you do. He was chubby and he was always running like, I don't know where it's going to be. Where are we put that? You know, and Edward Everett Horton. I mean, there were, and they did tend to play the same parts. But also, there were a lot more movies then. I mean, studios cranked them out. You know, they'd make movies in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks. A movie now is more of a special event. But I'm, you know, still, it is a little safer if you're a character actor, I must say. I've been in some movies that bombed and was not damaged whatsoever by them because I was just the character actor. I wasn't the name that was bringing you into the theater. And movie stars can have their careers very quickly ended by, you know, three flops in a row because it's perceived that they failed, not that the movie failed. But on the other hand, if you're in a huge hit and you're a character actor, you'll get more work eventually, but it doesn't redound on you the way it does if you're the star of the movie, which, you know, your salary doesn't suddenly triple.
Yeah. My guest today is Bob Balaban, a wonderful film actor, director, producer, and a young readers author. His latest book is The Creature from the Seventh Grade, Boy or Beast, and it's his second series of young readers that's just out. Well, when I was learning about you, I had no idea that your family has just been connected with show business. You know,
yeah, my family got into show business in 1908, I mean, in the form of show business. They were exhibitors, which meant that my grandmother got the idea. She had a delicatessen. It wasn't doing too well. They had a lot of trouble with the product because the lettuce would get stale. They'd have to throw it all out and buy new stuff. It didn't last very long. And also, my grandfather was a rather friendly sort, and he would allow people to buy on credit. So my grandmother wandered into a Nickelodeon in about 1908 and came out and said, "Boys," there were seven brothers at the time, "this is the business for us. You pay your money when you walk in. There's no credit in this. And when the movie gets old, you don't throw it out. You send away for a new one, and then they send you a fresh movie." So that was the business model.
Smart woman.
It really was. She was evidently, I never met her. She died many years before I was born. But she was, all of her children and my mother, who knew her because my mother was actually in the same family as my father, but I won't get into that too much. She was my father's first cousin once removed, so they all had the same relatives, basically. Yeah. But everybody did say she was a wonderful, prescient, interesting, fun woman. And about 14 years later, the family had built about 75 theaters in and around the Chicago area called Balaban and Katz. And at one point, I had a theater that sat more people than Radio City Music Hall. I think it was called the B&K Uptown. I'm not quite sure. And they were these picture palaces with ushers in uniforms and fantastic antiques from all over Europe. And it was the heyday of movies. It was before television and before the internet and before all the things that have bifurcated our. We have so many ways of watching things. There was one way: you went to a theater and you bought your ticket, and that was it. So it was a golden era and a lot of fun. And I wish I had known them more.
Was acting in your blood? Did you go to the theater as a kid?
The thing that was in my blood, actually, and it never occurred to me I would end up doing this because it seemed like such a flimsy way to make a living, and it is in many ways. It's very cyclical. But when I was a kid, I was a puppeteer, so I got to do everything. It's kind of like being a producer, if you think about it. You have to get the stage ready. You have to, get all the actors together. You have to find a script and kind of are in charge of everything, although it ends up being a puppet show. And I sort of trace, when I look back on it now, I go, yeah, that was that impulse, to perform, to create something. I wasn't necessarily good at it, but I was really in love with it. I always was. When I was 10, my grandfather, the Katz of Balaban and Katz, actually, ran a movie studio and eventually ended up at MGM in about 1933, and he started the musical unit and hired Arthur Freed, who produced, among many other things, Singing in the Rain and Gigi and a lot of my favorite musicals, actually. And when I was 10, I got to go to California. My grandparents would visit me. I had never been there before. And I got to go on the set at MGM. Well, you can imagine, I was this little starstruck puppeteer, basically, let loose in the candy store. So they drive me in, you know, the chauffeur and the driver, and we go through the gates, and everybody says, hello, Mr. Balaban, too. You know, I'm 10 years old. And I get driven onto the set. They were making Meet Me in Las Vegas with Sid Charisse and I think Dan Daly, and they were filming a scene in a gambling casino. I'd never seen anything like it in my life, and I was so imprinted from watching this giant set with cars outside actually driving and 400 extras screaming and gambling, and they'd yell action, it would all come to life, and they'd yell cut, and suddenly it would be quiet. It was like you could hear a pin drop. And Sid Charisse signed my cast. I had broken my arm. I was introduced to everybody. They made a chair for me that had my name on it, and that was it. I was hopelessly hooked, and it sort of started then.
Wow. Well, in the course of your career, you have worked with, I think, just about every major contemporary director around. Steven Spielberg, Robert Altman, Sidney Pollack, Sidney Lumet, Christopher Guest. The list just goes on. Wes Anderson, most recently.
Yeah, that was really, really fun.
Well, so take us back a few years. Steven Spielberg, you worked close to Encounters of the Third Kind. I think that would probably be your first big, huge movie.
Actually, the first two movies I did were both huge.
Well, that's right, Catch-22 and Midnight Cowboy. But
yeah, although Catch-22 was a kind of a huge failure, but it was a huge movie in the sense that it was the most popular book of the decade, basically. And there was more focus, you know, more attention focused on this thing. Orson Welles was in it. I mean, everybody that I, you know, every movie star that I was kind of aware of, Anthony Perkins and Marty Balsam, and just it had an amazing cast, Dick and Paula Benjamin. A lot of great people were in it. And the other one, yes, was Midnight Cowboy, which ended up winning the Best Picture that year. So I had a strangely sort of successful, well, not for me necessarily, but those movies were noticeable, you could say. And then I kind of floated around for 5 or 6 years, being in about 20 movies that you never heard of, like Me and Natalie starring Patty Duke and The Strawberry Statement about the Columbia riots with Bruce Davidson. Yeah,
you were like a rabble rouser or activist.
Mm. Well, I was typecast as a student at that point. I was on room 222. I was an activist. I chained myself to a tree. I didn't cut my hair for about a year and a half because I needed to have long hippie hair for those years. And then I graduated into lawyers.
And then Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which you're very important in the film, and you have one of these great movie moments, which is you show us what the alien ship looks like through your reaction.
Yeah, it was really very exciting. And during it, I mean, you never know if the movie's going to be a hit just because Steven directs it, because at that point, he'd only had one other huge movie. His previous movie was Jaws, which, you know, you couldn't get bigger than that, although this did, as it turned out. But, you know, you didn't know for sure that every single movie, which is pretty much true in Steven's case, was going to be a mega hit. But I did have a great time. It was wonderful being around François Truffaut. I wrote the making of the movie book about it called, at this point, it's called Spielberg, Truffaut, and Me. It's about a big movie from a small actor's point of view. But I was just, miraculous to be in that movie. The scenery, the special effects, being with Truffaut. I almost didn't get into the movie because they called me in and said, well, we just want to make sure you can speak French because you're going to play the interpreter, so you'll have to actually interpret. Do you speak French? Can you understand it? We're going to ask you to improvise some stuff with Truffaut. And I said, sure. And they called me in and I said, il y avait beaucoup d'années depuis que j'ai parlé français. Si vous me donnez ce boulot, ce sera très difficile pour moi. Yes, if you give me this job, it will be very difficult for me. I have not spoken French for many years. But nobody in the room spoke French, and they gave me the job. And then the first thing I did was go to Berlitz and drop about $500, and getting up to speed so I could actually converse with Truffaut, which I did. It was a really, really fun time.
And you were actually Truffaut's real interpreter when you were on the set because he didn't want to speak English.
Yeah, he really didn't like to. It kind of embarrassed him. And he did get into trouble when he spoke English sometimes. At one point, Steven called me into Dailies and said, we want to run this part where Truffaut says something. I think we're going to have you translate it. And they ran it for me, and Truffaut was saying something like, Zeblongir Mozambique. And I said, well, I'm sorry, guys. He's speaking English. They belong here more than we is what he's saying. But it kind of sounded like he was speaking French. So it was interesting. And also, Truffaut, Truffaut didn't like to speak English really because he felt his sense of humor couldn't be properly translated into English, or at least by him. Mm-hmm. He felt as an English-speaking person, he was rather dry. And he was. It is actually true. So he kind of liked having me around. I would read stuff for him, and I would turn his occasionally dry dialogue in conversations with people anyway into my own quirky English, I suppose. We actually double dated. He was going out with Terry Garr at the time, and my wife and I, and he and Terry used to run around together, and I had to tell Terry everything he was saying to her. It was, I guess you could say, it was a little bit like Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, right.
It's kind of like a Cyrano thing, although I was not in love with Terry, although I liked her very much.
Well, I want to talk about other movies, but I have to ask you about that scene where you're seeing the ship. I understand that Spielberg, basically, he was going back to old silent film, the way they would tell an actor how to react.
Yes, he did. You sound like you've read my book or something. I don't know. But it is true, because so much of that movie was green screen or blue screen or front screen, which means it's not there. You know, we're standing against a blank wall and asked to look at something and have an amazing reaction to it. Some directors just say, look, we're paying you money, you should figure it out for yourself. Steven went out of his way to make sure we knew what we were experiencing because, you know, it was going to be that much more rich for the movie if our reactions were more appropriate. So he did a couple of things, one of which was he had an elaborate series of beautiful small drawing storyboards, but they were more than that. They were full color. There were hundreds of them. And they literally showed you everything that was happening in the movie before he filmed it. It helped him design the effects, but it really did help the actors. He would take us in and have, you know, show us the boards for that scene. In one scene where Melinda Dillon has to watch the mothership coming over the mountain, and that's the mothership that's going to have her little son on it who's disappeared, little 4-year-old Carrie Guffey, who was quite amazing in the movie. And Melinda was sitting in some fake rocks looking up at some lights, and Steven was behind the camera, and I remember it. It was so interesting. He did for her what I imagine D.W. Griffiths might have done for Lillian Gish or somebody. He played the scene for her. Now the ship is coming over. It's in the distance. The lights are sparkling. They're twinkling. The air is still. I mean, he painted an entire picture.
Wow.
Actually, if it had been a silent movie, they probably would have played music for her or something. But he really did that. You know, Melinda would tear up every time he described it, and her eyes would grow wide. And it was really pretty amazing to watch Steven doing that because he didn't have a lot of formal training with actors anyway as a director, but he always had wonderful instincts and cast well and just dealt so nicely with people that he did, I think, got some wonderful performances out of everybody. And his work with the small boy was amazing. This was a 4-year-old child. And, you know, first of all, the kid was amazing because he had the patience and the temperament to be on a set. Most 4-year-olds would be screaming and crying, get me out of here. They don't know they're in a movie particularly. But this kid loved Steven. And Steven made a real point of getting to be friends with the kid, which wasn't hard because Steven loves children. So at one point, the boy, they put him a little playpen so he wouldn't, you know, get into trouble or touch a light or something. And Steven used to get in the playpen with him. I have some pictures of the two of them playing with toys in the playpen together. So the kid really loved Steven. And one day there was a scene where the aliens were kind of taking over the little objects in the house. Their electric field or the magnetic field was coming by. So everything was suddenly coming to life, the toy cars and the little rabbits that with their symbols that make noise. So without telling the boy that this was going to happen, he had him come downstairs, open a door, and they were shooting the whole thing. And when he opened the door, off camera, where the little boy could see, but the camera couldn't see, he had dressed about 10 crew members up in giant costumes of bunnies and owls and clowns and stuff. The little kid was just like laughing and applauding. It was so sweet. So when you see the reaction that the little kid has to his toys coming to life, he was actually looking at something that Steven designed specially for him. And the kid somehow knew he wasn't supposed to say, excuse me, Mr. Spielberg, what's happening? He literally just stood there and was in awe and had a fabulous reaction, and that's unusual for a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
Every time Melinda Dillon would cry, because he had a scene where there was about 20 takes, she had to discover him on the ship, and he would come running into her arms. And literally, they did it 20 times. Melinda had to break down happily when she saw her son. And every single take, if you ever see his face, the little kid is crying too. He was so empathetic, and it didn't upset him. He was just doing what a person he liked was doing.
Mm, that's great. My guest today, Bob Balaban, another great director and three memorable roles in the Christopher Guest films, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, Mighty Wind. And, of course, this is very different. You had outlines, you had storyboards. Here on these films, you had the barest of outlines.
Yes, you have a bare outline, and you have a great leader, because Christopher is sort of epitomizes what a movie director really can do, which is rather invisible and rather magical. Chris sets the tone for these movies without almost doing anything except casting them well and subtly encouraging you and making you feel like you have tremendous permission to fail, which is really very relaxing on a movie set. And he's very patient, so he waits for something funny to happen. He never pushes it. He encourages you not to try to be funny. He just wants you to be your character and deal with the situations. And it's really fun being on these sets because wonderful, strange things happen in front of you. It's never happening. It doesn't happen in a rehearsal. We don't rehearse particularly. In fact, I don't remember ever rehearsing. Sometimes he'll show you where you can go, like walk here and you can go over there. But aside from that, there really are very few instructions. But you know when he's pleased, and you know if he wants you to do something again. And he's quite capable of explaining or describing. But it's a great yin and yang that go on in those movies of how to leave it alone and then how to subtly tilt it. And he's great.
I would think it would be very interesting to see what the movie's like at the end, because you're probably doing
lots of... We have no idea.
You have no idea, and it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, so that's what you used.
Well, we're always somewhat disappointed when we love the movies and everything. But, for instance, in Waiting for Guffman, my character was a beekeeper, and I had an entire subplot. I mean, this was just something that occurred to me one day. It wasn't in the script or anything. I actually showed up for actual work one day, late from New York. I had actually directed a little movie, and I had to go to the opening of the movie. So Chris said, well, just come on the set whenever you're ready. Put your costume on and just walk out. So I walked out, and it suddenly occurred to me that the reason that I was late for whatever we were doing that day, in the movie anyway, was because I had stepped on my queen bee and simultaneously injured my foot. And actually, I did limp for the rest of the movie, although you never knew why, because he took away the bee part.
Oh, too bad.
But I also had a nice emotional moment. You know, I cared about bees, and with the queen gone, the whole hive had dissipated. But you never know what the movies will be like when they're over. The one thing you know is you probably made enough to make your own personal 7-hour movie, and you usually end up with about 10 minutes in the movie. So It's always a bit of a shock. But then you're so thrilled because the audience likes it so much.
I have to ask about one last director, and that's Robert Altman. You had I guess you were friends with Robert Altman for a long time.
I've known him forever. I actually met him for Brewster McCloud, when I was 22 years old, I think. And I always knew him, and he was very friendly, and he would invite us, my wife and me, to screenings of things. And he and his lovely wife, Catherine, we did a lot of stuff with them and got to be very friendly. And at one point, I was sitting in my office thinking, I'd like to produce a movie. And I thought, well, who do I know? I thought, I know Robert Altman. You know, he would be open to an idea. So I came up with the germ of the idea for Gosford Park and went to Robert, and happened to have worked with an unknown writer the year before on a project that never got made, whose name was Julian Fellowes. You now know him because he writes Downton Abbey and is extremely successful. But he really had never written a movie before at that point. And Robert and I just loved his ideas. And, you know, he pitched a lot of stuff to us based on our story. And he wrote the movie and he won an Academy Award. And I got to hang around another one of my most favorite directors, and in this case, a really good friend of mine, for a long time. And it was very, very rewarding and special.
Thanks for joining us.
Great, thanks.
Actor, director, producer, writer, and children's book author Bob Balaban speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent project is that new book, The Creature from the Seventh Grade, Boy or Beast, and you can see him in theaters in Moonrise Kingdom. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.